Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of over two dozen lodges situated around the globe, and we are dedicated to furthering the cause of universal brotherhood, which is a fact in nature. Now, we have no dues or fees. Everything that is done at the lodge is voluntary, it's from the heart, and it's all done voluntarily for the love of theosophy, which is divine wisdom. It's an ancient heritage which has been suppressed at various times during history. We're very fortunate to be able to discuss these ideas in a public forum. It is really a privilege, and it's one we hope that will never be taken away. So in order to do this, we have a couple of meetings every week, and then we have some special meetings periodically. On Wednesday evenings, we're studying in the Ocean of Theosophy. We're beginning the chapter on Kamaloka, which is an after-death state. That is on Wednesday evenings. The doors open at 5:30. There's a library open from 5:30 to 7:30 in the front of the building. It's a lending library.
No.
It's not a lending library. It's a reference library. There's always a student available for any direction if you in finding things. We have comparative religion, philosophy, science, and whatnot. You can do your own private study, or you can study for the evening's class. There is a reference for each Wednesday evening class, and so that is available at that time. There's a book table, which is open from 6:30 to slightly before the meeting, and we have straight-line theosophical pamphlets. We have some that are for free, some very low cost, some moderate cost, and none of them are expensive by today's standards because we do not charge for anything other than the paper, the print, and the shipping, basically. That's all that you pay for. And on Sunday mornings, we open at 10:30, and the meeting is from 11 to 12. All the meetings begin and end promptly. And we want to also mention that the work we have on hand and the end we keep in view, it's too absorbing and too lofty to take place in side issues. So we have one unassailable basis for union, and that is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. So we do not now, nor have we ever, discriminated on the basis of race, creed, religion, sex, or condition, and that covers everything because you come as you are and you are accepted as you are. It is an unfolding from within out, we believe, and or so it is postulated. It welcomes all to its association. We welcome all to our association who are in accord with declared purposes and desire to fit themselves by study or otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. Now this morning's meeting, there'll be two short talks followed by discussion. The topic for the month is comparative religions, service to others. This week, it is reverence for life and nature, and so that's what we will begin with now. Now, the first speaker will be talking about organized religions and their take on life and nature. There'll be some quotes read, a little bit of background information, and then the second teacher will discuss what similarities or differences are held by the theosophical view of reverence to life and nature. Now, it's interesting that the whole ecology movement, which is very much in the forefront of everyone's minds today, it wasn't that way at one time, because life and nature was considered to be an inexhaustible source. When the Europeans came to this country, they looked around and they saw this paradise and they figured it was inexhaustible. But as the Industrial Revolution came, especially, and the effects in the 20th century and materialism, which really ran rampant, and all the pollution and whatnot, people started to question that the biblical in the Bible, you know, to go forth and to have dominion and to be able to use nature. So there's this, on the one hand in the Bible, it says to have dominion, but another interpretation is to have stewardship. And now we're getting more toward the stewardship. We should have more of a stewardship toward our environment. But what people do about their ecology depends on what they think about themselves in relation to the things about them. Human ecology is deeply conditioned by beliefs about our nature and destiny, that is, by religion. It has been asserted that Western Christianity is the most anthropomorphic religion the world has seen, and this overemphasis on anthropomorphism or anthropocentrism gives humans permission to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the integrity of natural objects. So there's this Christian arrogance towards nature now bears this huge burden of guilt, which is a driving force for the contemporary environmental crisis. So in Genesis, it says that in the Judeo-Christian book that we're all familiar with, the Bible, the scripture talks about a special relationship that God has with human beings through the Latin is imagio Dei, which is the doctrine that men and women are created in the image of God. And for centuries, many Christians have taken a positive view of nature and the special relationship that humans have with God to mean that humans are called to be wise stewards or caretakers of the earth. So that is the opposite of just having dominion and having what is, in a sense, a monarchy of humanity over creation. And that is the culprit of the Christian attitude that denigrates the importance of nature. Now, St. Francis was an exception to this, St. Francis of Assisi. And also the Orthodox traditions of Eastern Christianity, they are what are environmentally friendly expressions of the Christian faith. And it's interesting that it's been pretty well, not exactly documented, but just by looking at the life of St. Francis and the time that he lived, that he was influenced by the Sufis and by the Eastern ideas at that time. The Spain and parts of Italy were ruled by the Muslims at that time during his lifetime. So he did have an influence. And it's also very interesting that the the Order of St. Francis, or of the Lesser Brothers, and he refused to become a priest. He did not want to be a priest. So he founded a very humble order, and just the way they dress and the way they act and the way they're organized, that they are very similar to a Sufi order. And he had great respect and reverence for the environment. Now, Islam also, they have kept their respect for the environment, actually. They have been influenced by the West, just because of the Western dominance of the world and its markets and commerce. But they acknowledge an Islamic doctrine. I won't say the Islamic words because I don't know how to pronounce them. But their doctrine is of unity, trusteeship, and accountability. And so these three central concepts of Islam are also the pillars of Islam's environmental ethic. But they add that Muslims have strayed away from this nexus of values and they need to return to it. Humankind is given the role of trustee. And a quote from Islam is, "Behold, the Lord said to the angels, I will create a vice regent on earth, but it is a role that each person must perform wisely and responsibly, fully aware of human accountability to the Almighty." And here's a quote, "Do no mischief on the earth after it hath been set in order, but call on him with fear and longing in your hearts, for the mercy of God is always near those who do good." Now here's an interesting thing from an Islamic scholar. He said, this is from, his name is Syed Hossein Nasser, and he said, "Western science has become illegitimate because scientists and the rest of society fail to see the need for a higher knowledge into which it could be integrated. The spiritual value of nature is destroyed. We can't save the natural world except by rediscovering the sacred in nature. The whole of nature is descended from higher spiritual realms. There can be no sacredness of the earth without the sacredness of heaven. Man is that special creature who transcends the earth. A theology is not valid unless we remember where the sacred comes from. The idea that man comes out of the land or out of mud, so to speak, is false. It simply provides a way of reducing the higher to the lower." And he goes on and makes several points that, and here's another one here, about how nature has been denigrated. "It is much more dangerous in the West today. They want to remove problems brought on by destroying the balance between man and nature through further domination of nature. The problem is not really underdevelopment in the third world, but overdevelopment brought on by the West." So, there is a remarkable unanimity that humankind descends from a celestial archetype, but does not ascend from the ape or any other creature. And this is in Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, Islam, and all the other Eastern traditions. They don't believe in a man that ascends from the lower, but rather descends from the higher, and that is the natural order. And this is interesting, and this is true, that this is the pattern of life in Islam and Islamic countries. In the traditional Islamic pattern of life, work is not separated from life, but reflects natural rhythms. An artisan's workday, for example, may last from dawn until long after sunset, but the work is done in the bazaar, the bosom of the community, and is interrupted by coffee drinking with friends, dining at home with family, prayers at the mosque, or quiet meditation. So there's there's a sense of rhythm and a sense of balance there. Wanted to mention briefly Teilhard de Chardin, who was a Jesuit scientist, philosopher, and theologian. And he was smart. He waited till after he died till all his really radical things were published. and they all got out there, so he didn't have to battle with the church during his day. But he talks about an omega point, which is a coalescence of consciousness that will lead to a new state of peace and planetary unity. Long before ecology was fashionable, he died in 1955. He saw this unity as being intrinsically upon the spirit of the earth, and he calls this the nosphere, and nos being Greek for the sphere of thought. It is analogous to a planetary level of evolution as the cerebral cortex is in the human. So, of course, the Native American tradition, Chief Seattle, we have really, you know, way more material than we have time for. So we will now move on to the theosophical view of life and nature.
As we're beginning to see then, reverence for life and nature is a common ethic that is expressed in many religious traditions around the world, and it has become a basis for movements for the conservation of natural resources, protection of the environment, and movements that promote compassion and harmlessness as much as possible to all sentient living beings. However, as we have seen, and we'll see as we individually study reverence for life and nature as taught in religions, that the reverence for life is directed to forms of life. And when we think about it, the attitude of reverence is one of respect and awe for the divine and sacred. And religions tend to endow nature and the forms of life with sanctity because they are said to be created by a supreme divine being. That's how they get their sanctity, through that act of divine creation. And also, it's interesting that the reverence of life, as we read and study the quotations for many of the religions, leaves out the mineral kingdom, unless the forms of the mineral kingdom have been shaped into some object that is seen to represent the deity. The mineral kingdom is generally left out because of the consideration that it is not alive, not conscious, and not intelligent. So we're moving then to the theosophical viewpoint. While theosophy shares that ethic of reverence to life and nature common to many religious traditions, its understanding of what the meaning of life is and what nature is much more universal. And if we think about it, we know that we just don't live in our physical bodies. We are thinkers. We live in the mind. It is a very essential part of our conscious existence. And we live in different states of consciousness. And the sages from different world religions even speak of a conscious life in spirit. So life has to expand to not just physical, but considerations of mental and spiritual life, one life, if you will. And then we also need to understand that a life is more than just plants and animals and human beings. For even minerals, in the theosophical idea, are alive and conscious and intelligent in their own degree. In fact, there is no point in space, no atom even, that is devoid of consciousness, life, and intelligence, because life itself is a pervasive, universal force, the manifestation of that unknown, absolute one life we call deity. So reverence for life, from a theosophical point of view, is an attitude of mental devotion, mental union with that supreme divine source of all, the one life. And its most practical expression is universal brotherhood. Now, nature then, and reverence for nature, is much more than worshiping stones and plants and animals and thinking that every stone and plant and animal is a deity. This is a misunderstanding of the ancient idea of pantheism, or the reverence and worship of nature. According to theosophy, if we want to understand nature, the mysteries of nature, we need to understand to begin with the human being, because that's what we know the best. And we are to know ourselves, and what we find is that the human being, and this is repeated throughout the ages in different ways, is a mirror, a reflection, a copy of great nature, that all of nature is reflected in the human being. So that we say, and we hear in the Bible in different traditions, that the human being is a composite of body, soul, and spirit, and correspondingly nature, we might say, has a physical aspect, an indwelling mental or intelligent soul aspect, and a higher permanent guiding, directing spiritual aspect. Now, corresponding to the physical body of the human being, we see that nature around us takes on many different objective forms in all the different kingdoms, but these are transitory, impermanent, and they are we might say shadows, in the sense that they have no permanent existence, and yet they are very important to us. They are instruments, they are vehicles for the expression of that which is real. Nevertheless, even though these forms of life, including our own physical form, is temporary, just as we care for the body by providing it the proper conditions for its existence, so too there can be a reverence for the objective, temporary, phenomenal beings and forms of nature in the different kingdoms by physical acts which protect and preserve them, and the use of our gift of speech to defend and protect the rights of all beings who cannot speak for themselves. Corresponding to the soul, the inner thinking real man, if you will, the real inner indwelling self-conscious being who is the director of the physical body, there is that collectivity of intelligent divine forces within all of nature, and the different religious traditions speak of them. In the Western traditions, we have the idea presented of angels, and in the Eastern traditions we have the idea of hierarchies of intelligent devas or spiritual beings. And so as we care for our soul, our inner mental life, by trying to encourage within ourselves the most uplifting thoughts and feelings that will allow for our own mental and physical health, so too we can respect this inner soul life and intelligence of nature around us by trying to, as much as we can, be generators of those thoughts and feelings that will uplift the intelligence, the consciousness in all the different kingdoms. Because as universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, we are all connected. All the different kingdoms of nature are connected, not only physical, in the sense they share the same physical substance, but we interconnected in our psychic life and in our spiritual life. The third aspect of nature would be to see corresponding to our own inner spiritual nature, which is permanent, enduring, the most real part of us. And as we understand that part of our true self to be permanent, enduring, divine, if you will, so too this aspect of nature is the divine, permanent, spiritual, and material essence and source of all the different degrees of form, all the different degrees of intelligence we see in nature. Just as science teaches that matter and energy are the source and origin of all things on the physical plane, and that they are interconvertible, so too spirit substance is one, two aspects of the same reality, which in its highest expression, that most ethereal expression, universal, is the source of all the different aspects of nature. We see this idea of the emanation, the bringing forth in gradual stages of evolution, the six creations, the 7 days of creation, this idea of emanation and development from the one source being expressed in all the different, in many different religions. So as we revere that spiritual presence as it wells up in our intuition, in the deepest depths of our heart and minds, and we might say even worship it by our mental devotion and silent meditation and prayer, so too we can revere that same divine presence as it must be expressed in all the different kingdoms of nature. And that is by an attitude of thought, feeling, words, and deeds in which we act for and as that one self of all. The true reverence of life and nature is to realize that there is no separateness. We are not stewards, even in the sense we are separate from nature, but all of nature is one. We are part of it. We just happen to be one of the most complete expressions of it, and that gives us a very important point of responsibility and influence. Now, we're sure you have some questions and comments on this subject. Yes?
Well, we know that the lower kingdoms do not have a mind that we have. So for us to communicate with them, we don't think we can do it through words. That it's more of a feeling, or a thought, feeling, word, and deed. What aspect of ourselves do we use to communicate with all these lower kingdoms?
The question relates to how do we interact, communicate with the various kingdoms of nature. Well, of course, in terms of the use of the word, we know that we can communicate with the various, some of the animals through speech, but that also animals, even plants, respond to feeling, our emotional nature. And plants and animals also respond emotionally and sense what is being experienced by other members of their species. So that the communication that goes on is not on the outer physical plane, but on the very real thought, or very real plane of spiritual and psychic life. All of life is conscious, intelligent, some degree of consciousness and intelligence working through some degree of form. And just as we have an inner life of thought, feeling, imagination, memory, intuition of varying degrees of strength and influence, so too there is a corresponding inner dimension of feeling and intelligence in these kingdoms. And that's on the level we communicate. Our thought and our feeling sets up vibrations that can be detected even in the mineral kingdom. Yes, in the back.
To follow up on that, we read a book. It was one of the most amazing things. It was called The Secret Life of Plants. And they even did, you know, they hooked them up to electrodes, and even the human standing by it or even in another room, if it thought that it, if it said like, I'm going to set fire to you kind of a thing to the plant, just thinking it, the plant reacted with the, you know, almost like a heart monitor kind of a thing. And we always know, like if a you know, if you come upon a dog and they're angry for what, a growling, they, you know, it's, you, we always, we grew up with the thought, don't let him know that you're scared.
Yes.
Which means trying to control your feelings too. So it is, it's just on a completely different plane, you know, that we can communicate with that.
And even in the mineral kingdom, one of the finest research scientific examples of that is the research that's done by the Japanese scientist who looks at the life of water and how water is influenced by our collective and individual thought and feeling, the degree to which it can crystallize into beautiful, harmonious forms or chaotic, disturbed forms is directly related to the quality and the kind of thought and feeling that is impressed on the water by human beings. And so we have more and more evidence that there needs to be a more determined reverence of life, because all of life is responding. And as it responds, of course, by this law of action and reaction, it will react to us. That as we work with nature, nature in return and responds and works with us.
Perhaps a short excerpt from Chief Seattle talking about how sacred nature is to his people. He says, every part of this country is sacred to my people. Every hillside, every valley, every plain and grove has been hallowed by some fond memory or some sad experience of my tribe. Even the rocks that seem to lie dumb as they swelter in the sun along the silent seashore in solemn grandeur thrill with memories of past events connected with the fate of my people. And the very dust under your feet responds more lovingly to our footsteps than to yours, because it is the ashes of our ancestors, and our bare feet are conscious of the sympathetic touch, for the soil is rich with the life of our kindred.
Yes. Yes.
For me, it's one thing that it's hard for me to understand is the higher intelligence creatures, like dolphins. I have a parrot myself, and the intelligence of this creature is just amazing, in both emotional intelligence and the ability to, you know, do complex tasks and things. And so, you know, comparing destiny of a human and what a human's supposed to do and the responsibilities, you know, I get that, but then, you know, then we talk about the lower forms, but there are these in-between creatures, which I don't know what, you know, do they have a soul? Do they reincarnate? I've read somewhere that, you know, a human love can actually cause an animal soul to become, to have a soul and then reincarnate. So I don't know if you have any thoughts theosophically about this.
From the perspective of the theosophical teachings, reincarnation for the human being applies specifically to the idea that in the human being we have an individual self-conscious thinking entity, an individual soul, a same identical soul that incarnates from life to life. Now, in the kingdoms below the human, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, there is astounding intelligence, which is evidence to the inner soul life. And whereas the intelligence there is a collectivity of intelligence, just as our bodies are made of a collectivity of lives working together as one unit, the intelligence of that kind of being, that collectivity does not disappear, with the death of the body, but even those intelligent beings and forces that make up that kingdom come back and are re-expressed in some higher degree. It is the teaching of theosophy that this universe is embodied consciousness, that all in nature and all the kingdoms are alive and conscious in their own degree, and the great purpose of evolution, of which the human being has a pivotal role because of free will and choice, is for the lifting up and the raising up of that consciousness in all those kingdoms to the point that they can be self-consciously aware of their divinity at some future point in evolution.
It is interesting that the varying degrees of intelligence in the animal kingdom, but they do not have apperception. They're not conscious of their consciousness. They are conscious, and they are reactive, and they have intelligence, but they do not have that self-reflective consciousness. They have more of a group consciousness. Now, of course, there's more and more studies are being done, but we would just want to put out there, we have thought, well, we're taking them out of their natural environment and we're reacting to them and we're seeing how their intelligence is in respect to our intelligence. But it's only fairly recently that we've been able, through, you know, cameras and surveillance, to observe them in their natural environment undisturbed by humans. And so we wonder that we know that all animals communicate with one another, but we're trying to find out how they communicate. But it's just like, you know, but when we're communicating with them, we're, in a sense, their intelligence is being used in other more novel ways that isn't their natural environment. It's an environment, but it's, now, of course, there's animals that have been working with man for many years, for thousands of years, beasts of burden, so-called beasts, well, they are beasts, like horses and elephants and, you know, they're, and dogs and cats. They're acculturated to, in a sense, we've removed them so far from their natural environment, but this is their new natural environment in a way. We think. We're just putting some thoughts out there.
Yes, in fact.
Well, we were thinking about a couple of things. We were thinking about, in the mineral kingdom, that cohesion, the fact that the stone stays a stone, the spring of sand stays, so that's got to be some sort of intelligence. And then, of course, the knowing of the consciousness is, for anybody that's done any camping, and trying to start a fire with either taking two sticks of wood or smacking stones, certain stones together, we can see that intelligence in there, in those lives, whatever, that's keeping it together.
Yes. The intelligence in the mineral kingdom, it says, we use the term cohesion. The natural tendency we see in nature is for things to fly apart and scatter. So there is an intelligence force or that brings things together. And it's not in a haphazard way. It's in a very specific structure. So we look at the different chemicals and elements, and we see that they each have their own design and they act predictably. We call them the laws of physics or the laws of chemistry. But as we look at it further, we see that if you take a drop of one chemical substance and you put it in the presence of two other chemical substances, it will selectively imbibe or be attracted to one substance and incorporate it into its nature and repel the other. So we see the selective building up of the form in a very predictable way. And the fact that it is intelligent and predictable, I mean, these things can be mathematically determined and modeled, so we know there is guidance, plan, there's order. So from the outer point of view, scientists call this the laws of nature or the laws of physics or the laws of chemistry. But from the point of view of divine wisdom, we see it's the expression, the expression of these laws are the effects, and the causes are the inner intelligence guiding and working through those particular forms. Yes?
And to connect these ideas with ourselves as human beings, as thinkers, we often can go to poetry to get in touch with the idea brought out by the lecture this morning. The song, Trees, I think that I shall never see a poet as lovely as a tree. And if we go on further, only God can make a tree with the statement. And in some of those texts, the religions that we talked about earlier, we have heard of the cedars of Lebanon, the pines tree and its place in symbology in our culture. So man, when he respects nature and speaks that way of it, there is a relationship, really, and trees and flowers, of course, tend to form a relationship which is lasting, it seems, and beautiful to think about.
Did you have a comment?
Well, you mentioned poetry, and this is another short poetic statement. Life is mostly froth and bubble. Two things stand like stone. Kindness in another's trouble, courage in your own. And that was by Adam Lindsay Gordon, who we're not familiar with, but we thought it was a wonderful quote to get out of your own way. You know, get out of your own way, your own thoughts, your own, that froth and bubble of the daily world, and to be open and sensitive to another's trouble, and to have courage in your own. That way you gain strength. You gain that strength of the cedar of Lebanon, which is a symbol for the Druzes, we believe, which are a mystical sect that come from all over. They came from all over. They were to keep the mystery, to keep the theosophical knowledge pure during times of trouble.
It's interesting that if we go back to the Bible, in Genesis chapter 2, God has created Adam in the story of the Garden of Eden. And he sees that Adam is alone, and so he creates for him a woman. And then all of nature is created. And he instructs Adam to be to till and care for the garden. And you think about it, now wait a second, we have this Garden of Eden created, this ideal paradise. What does it need for man to till and guide it? Is God just giving him busy work? You know, why does it need that care? And then in chapter 3, Adam and Eve were specifically warned that they could eat of all the fruit and all the trees except the tree of knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life. And of course, Adam and Eve, they eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, And the punishment is that they will no longer be able to bear forth fruit from nature with ease, that nature will now have enmity towards them, and they will have to bear it forth in suffering. Now that's interesting, that at one point nature is beautiful and harmonious, and at another point, because of something that's changed within the human being, it now becomes possible for nature to be the enemy of man, and be the obstacle for human progress and happiness. What is the message of this story in Genesis? And we think part of it is that man, in the second chapter, can be a co-worker with nature. To care and till with nature is to understand it and bring it to its fruition, to guide nature. Nature, in some ways, is in a cooperative relationship with the human being, a higher degree of intelligence. But once we acquire the knowledge of good and evil, a moral ability for choice, free will and choice, we have the ability to work against that law of harmony in nature, and nature will respond because of those acts and that very power of our thinking in ways that work against us. So reverence for nature is not just respect and love of the divine and sacred. It's also, as reverence is an element of awe, respect, and we might even say fear for what nature can do in return if we mistreat it. And a lot of the calamities and catastrophes that we see in nature are not, as taught in some religions, acts of God, but are the lawful consequences of the way we've mistreated nature through our self-conscious thoughts, feelings, words, and deeds.
One of my favorite bumper stickers is "Eve was framed," because she gets blamed for taking the first bite of the fruit. But really, it was all part of the natural process. We were made not to be in a static state of just natural bliss. We think it wouldn't have lasted anyway, because our nature as human beings is to know, to find out, to be curious. The gods are jealous of us, it was said, because we do have that free will and choice. And we only learn by mistakes anyway. So, yes, we came from this blissful state, but that only further reinforces what Theosophy says, that evolution begins from above. And then it involves itself. We had to get involved with nature, and we're trying to raise up all of nature and then evolve. And we have a long, long period of time in evolution to accomplish this feat, that it is a great feat. And much work had already taken place in the formation of the life forms before we incarnated into them, into these forms. We actually fashioned these forms when we were in higher realms on other planes, and then entered the form. So the knowledge of good and evil, that is something that we have to go through. Eve should really be given credit for being the first one to be curious and to experiment. And then Adam tagged along.
But isn't it true, talking about law, aren't we all governed by electrical, magnetic impulses, that all of the nature kingdoms have a design body, and these rooms we call it the astral body, that is magnetic and electrical, and really this is what we have in common with all of life. So is not this the avenue that we communicate with all the other kingdoms through our feeling nature?
Interesting. The electrical magnetic aspects of life. This was a principle that was taught in theosophy in the 1800s, but wasn't really understood by science until well into the latter part of the 20th century, when we developed the technology to be able to detect the electromagnetic fields. And of course, within the fields of physics and biology and sociology and psychology, there's this whole concept of field, that the reality is the force field which shapes and determines the expression of the forms, that it is the source of life. And all different degrees of life, the mineral and water included, can be measured to their electrical magnetic frequency. But electromagnetic impulse or electricity, like life itself, has its many different expressions. There is the electric force we see in lightning, but we also have its equivalents within our mental and spiritual nature. We can even see how ideas and flashes of insight can strike us as lightning and have the same impact. Spiritual insight and intuition can be an electrical dynamic force. So we can use this idea of electricity and magnetism and expand it into a universal principle. It's an expression of that universal life.
It's interesting because we do have instruments that can measure electromagnetic forces and various fields, but there have always been mystics and clairvoyants that could see to the heart of the matter, that could see these fields, and they're as real to them as any physical form is. And it's interesting. We saw recently that the basis for the series Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes was a doctor who could somehow just look at a person and diagnose, and that's what he used him in, as a detective. He used his, a model for a detective that could kind of like deduce things seemingly out of nowhere. But there are those that can, and these powers are slowly awakening in mankind. They will become the common property of mankind as we develop, that we'll have these abilities in the future. And apparently there are more and more people that have these abilities than ever have.
We were thinking that those stories of Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who did have some contact and influence with the theosophical movement in those times, was showing the power of intellect, of reason, and his hero could solve the mysteries of life through the application of reason to get at the crime or the source of the mystery. But if that's the case, how can we have such a beautiful insight as expressed by Chief Seattle, where his people who are not all Sherlock Holmes, who are not all presenting themselves as model of intellectual reason and superiority, and yet can sense and feel a sacredness in life, in the very dust and world they walk on, that can sense the presence of intelligence connected with them in the world around them. So, yes, it may be that in the future, humanity, as our intellectual and psychic abilities expand, will realize that. But we already have it. We already have had the intuitional ability to understand these things. We can do it right now. And the expression of that intuitional awareness of the oneness and sacredness of life irrepressibly shows itself in our reverence for life and nature, to the best that we can. Yes?
And isn't that a good description of the animal versus the human kingdom? The animal using, I don't know if we'd say logic, but at least instinct, goes to the same place for food, knows that this is what it can eat, where the human can touch that intuition and decide if this is the right moral choice in the moment. So we see there's a great vast difference. Although we're having influence all the time on those lower kingdoms, there's only a certain point up to which they can reach at this level.
Yes. We call intuition acting unself-consciously without the guidance of intellect through the animal kingdom. We call it instinct. It's direct perception of knowledge of the group of beings as to what to do and act in different circumstances. And there's not much variance from that. It's predictable. That's why we call it instinctive. And we know now, we see the confusion of the plant life around us. It thinks it's springtime now. And we have flowers, we have birds who usually migrate up in April starting to come up now. They don't know what to do because they can't find the food sources. So there's an instinctive response of these kingdoms to nature. Of course, but in the case of pets or domesticated animals where there is that's closer electromagnetic contact between them and humanity and their owners, that the intelligence of the human, the character, even the morality of the human interacts and influences the animal life around it. It's the source of that idea in the Bible where it says at a certain time in the future when man has risen to a high spiritual state, the lamb and the lion will lie down together. Whereas instinctively right now, they seem to be mortal enemies. Yes?
If I could just take a moment, because there was, I think, a really important undercurrent that I want to make sure I got right. So I spent most of my life trying to intellectualize things, but I think what maybe you were referencing is the way that this reference is best communicated through a feeling and not through a thought. And that's like a magnetic field, and that's kind of like a intellectual definition of what this reverence is, and a way to connect with nature is more through a feeling and not through a thought. So is that what people are trying to say? Is that all of a sudden just made sense to me?
Well, there is definitely a feeling of reverence, and yet we need to think about it. Our thoughts and feelings as human beings are interblended because the faculty of our mind includes thought and feeling. But as is our reverence, our understanding of reverence, so will be our thought. If we want to enhance the feeling we have for all of life, we have to begin to think intellectually, or at least consider ideas about life that are different than the ones we may have been taught. We need to educate the heart. And if we want to begin to expand our ideas about life and nature and the world around us, we have to take that feeling of love and devotion and reverence that we may have, maybe just for ourselves or our family or a small group, and expand it by practice and application to wider and wider circles. So we need to educate the heart and illuminate the reason. Yes?
One of the things that I find most astounding about being a human being and with regard to instinct and intuition is when we communicate with people on a day-to-day basis, one of the things that we're able to do, which I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for, is to really understand and anticipate the needs of others apart from what they're literally saying to us. And I think that that's a gigantic percentage of speech, to the point where sometimes wonder if human beings are not already telepathic, but we just don't think of it in that way. And, you know, I mean, if somebody says to you, you never take the garbage out, and you know that you do every day, well, what you really know is that that person's probably either having a bad day or that something else has happened to them. In that respect, and I think going back to the beginning of what started this discussion off, which is, you know, what's our place in terms of stewardship in with animals and plants that can't necessarily communicate with us in a way that we communicate with each other, I think what's important to remember is maybe that because we have that ability to anticipate the needs of ourselves and the environment around us through scientific inquiry, that maybe that's part of the responsibility that is laid upon us.
So your contribution beautifully summarizes some of the points that we've tried to make, that we live not just on the physical plane, but in our minds. And in our minds, we can sense the needs of other sentient beings like us, most like us, the humans around us. But all of nature is sentient. And we can learn to respond to the needs of those forms of life. And we'll just close here with an idea expressed in the Jainism religion, to paraphrase, is just as we would understand that an individual, a human being who is mute, who is deaf, who is paralyzed, is nevertheless conscious, intelligent, and sensitive, and has needs, how much more can we be aware of the mineral, which is deaf, mute, unable to express itself, and yet has its needs, consciousness, awareness, intelligence, and we should respond to that. So our meeting is adjourned, and we welcome you next week for a further consideration on devotion to others.